Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.5 billion back to our customer owners over the last 9 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
Time. It's always vanishing. The commute, the errands, the work functions, the meetings, selling your car. Unless you sell your car with Carvana. Get a real offer in minutes. Get it picked up from your door. Get paid on the spot. So fast, you'll wonder what the catch is. There isn't one. We just respect you and your time. Oh, you're still here? Move along now. Enjoy your day. Sell your car today. Carvana. Pickup fees may apply.
Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking, they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Around daybreak on July 29, 1910, three black teenagers were walking home through the piney woods of East Texas. They'd spent the night at a grandmother's house, and now they were headed out to feed their livestock. In the dim light, they spotted a half dozen white men ahead. Two of the teens even recognized them. Armed white men in the woods weren't an unusual sight in East Texas back then. Hunting was common and guns were everywhere. But these men weren't out hunting deer. Without a word, they raised their shotguns and opened fire on 18-year-olds Les Colley and Cleve Larkin and 15-year-old Charlie Wilson. Larkin fell where he stood. Wilson, hit in the thigh and ankle, somehow managed to run, adrenaline and terror propelling him through the dense loblolly and longleaf pines, through sticky marshes, until he and Holly reached cover. Over the next 48 hours, every black resident of Slocum, Texas, would try to outrun the hate. Not all of them would succeed. The blame for the massacre would take a variety of guises. Maybe it was about money, maybe about employment, maybe it was about the outcome of a boxing match. But it was always told as if it were the fault of some black man or black family. The local newspapers would report it was a race riot, that the black population had in some way overreached and, having gotten above their station, pushed the white population to respond. But this was not a race war. Hell, even the sheriff who came in to quell the disturbance would tell the big city newspapers immediately after he'd restored order that all of the victims had been black. All had been unarmed. And for the most part, they had all been shot in the back. How many are we talking? No one counted then. No one can count now. Maybe it was 50. Maybe it was in excess of 200. Fear of more killings kept some of the survivors silent. Fear of prosecution hushed the rest. Constance Holly Jewade, a direct descendant of one of the dead, told KLTV that the stories went underground but were never forgotten.
My grandfather shared stories of the massacre with me, my uncles, my father. This is a history that has been in our family since 1910.
Texas, meanwhile, has been disturbingly reticent to acknowledge this history-changing event even occurred. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hungry Root. When it comes to grocery shopping and meal planning, I've got this problem now that we're shifting into fall routines, school, teaching, work, and then suddenly it's dinner time.
Yeah, that's when the let's just eat cereal option starts sounding pretty good.
But all that's gonna change thanks to Hungry Root. It's the easiest way to eat healthy. It's like having a personal shopper and nutritionist all in one. They fill our cart with healthy groceries and recipes tailored to what we actually like.
And you've noticed they're learning your tastes, right? The suggestions get smarter every week.
Exactly. The last box had boiled eggs, quinoa, peanut butter, even better for you chips.
And H has been into the kids' snacks section, which makes packing lunches a whole lot easier. You're going to love Hungry Root as much as I do. Take advantage of this exclusive offer. For a limited time, get 40% off your first box, plus get a free item in every box for life. Go to thehungryroot.com/COTC, use code COTC.
That's hungryroot.com/COTC, code COTC, to get 40% off your first box and a free item of your choice for life. hungryroot.com/COTC, code COTC. The story of what happened in 1921 when a mob of white Tulsans attacked and burned much of the Greenwood District, known as Black Wall Street, began resurfacing in the 1970s and early 1980s. Awareness of the destruction, the displacement of 10,000 residents, and the ongoing search for mass graves has grown significantly over the past decade. Some call it an essential benchmark in understanding the horrors, past and present, that Black Americans have faced in a country supposedly built on liberty and justice for all. The 1923 massacre in Rosewood, Florida, has also become more widely known since journalist Gary Moore of the St. Petersburg Times investigated the long-buried story in the early 1980s. His reporting revealed how, following the lynching of a Black man, white mobs killed as many as 150 Black Floridians, burned down the town, and forced survivors to flee forever. The story was later told in film, and the site is now marked as a Florida Heritage Landmark. But the story of the Slocum Massacre remains largely buried. It took more than a century for it to even be told properly. And don't think for a second that was an accident. East Texas wanted it that way. So, let's back up to the weeks leading up to July 29th, 1910, and look at the rumored sparks for the slaughter. Some believe tensions between white and Black residents of Anderson County ignited over a minor dispute between Marsh Holly, a Black businessman, and a disabled white man whose name appeared in newspaper as Redden Alford, Rexford Alford, or Alfred Anderson. We'll call him Alford. Anyway, Holly and Alford had a difference of opinion on a $70 promissory note that Holly was late in paying. The Hollies were well known in Slocum. Marsh and Jack, I could not ferret out their actual relationship to one another, both figured largely in what happened. Just know that Marsh Holly was the supposed debtor, and Jack Holly was a very prominent Black entrepreneur in town who owned 700 acres of land, had a granary, a dairy, a grocery store, and was the father of the teenaged Lusk. Marsh, though not as prominent as Jack, was well thought of in town and repeatedly told authorities later that the whole promissory note business was a small thing and that neither he nor Alford were all that concerned that it wouldn't be paid or ironed out somehow. That said, Marsh was, at some point just after the massacre, found by white authorities who put him in protective custody as they feared he was to die next. It's also important to know that Jack, who had been enslaved as a younger man, had really made something of himself, and that in itself may have prompted a lot of the white anger in Slocum. In short, it's fair to say that while some claim the promissory note dispute lit the fuse, the evidence for that is sketchy. Now, another theory thrown out is that the white residents were mighty upset by the outcome of the so-called Fight of the Century, the American boxing bout between two undefeated world heavyweight champions, James Jeffries and Jack Johnson. Jeffries had come out of retirement for the big fight and was the heavy favorite for the July 4th, 1910 event held in Reno, Nevada. Johnson was the first Black world heavyweight champion, a native Texan who had been born and raised in Galveston. The media made clear this was a battle of the races. Prior to the fight, Jeffries was nicknamed the Great White Hope and bragged that he had never failed in the ring. During the fight, though, he fell three times, but roused to continue on. He lasted until the 15th round when, recognizing the beating Jeffries was taking, his manager threw in the white towel. Johnson's victory set off what historians would later term the first truly nationwide race riots in the United States. White America's shock over a white man being bested by a black man, and black America's pride in that, shook loose public demonstrations in Atlanta, Baltimore, Cincinnati, Houston, Kansas City, Los Angeles, New York, Omaha, Philadelphia, and St. Louis. Little towns weren't immune to the violence either. In all, it's estimated that as many as 26 people were killed and hundreds injured in the aftermath. And sure, the reverberations likely reached the backwoods of East Texas, but the theory that this prompted what happened in Slocum has little to back it up. So that leaves us with the rather innocuous decision made by a county road maintenance supervisor to tell Slocum's Abe Wilson, a black farmer and father of 15-year-old Charlie, that he could round up some locals for country road repairs. It was, at best, an informal and offhand decision to hire a guy to fix a road. This seriously ruffled the feathers of Jim Spurger, a white farmer who had a history of hostility toward his black neighbors. Mind you, Wilson never asked Spurger to help him on the road crew. It was the principle of the thing, as E.R. Bills writes in the 1910 Slocum Massacre, an act of genocide in East Texas. Quote, "The Confederacy was 45 years departed, but broadly speaking, the Caucasian population of Texas did not consider African Americans their equals and went to great general, specific, and systemic lengths to keep blacks second-class citizens in virtually every community. Ergo, black men did not tell white men it was time to help with the county road maintenance." End quote. And as these things tend to morph in the retelling, the story soon became that a black man was going to be the overseer of white men tasked with working on the roads. That was an outrage. Simultaneously, the Holly Alford minor disagreement ballooned into a case of a black man cheating a white man, one who had a handicap and was struggling, no less. Then things very quickly got weird. Overnight, word spread that black citizens in three adjacent counties, Anderson, Houston, and Cherokee, were meeting and plotting an insurgency the likes of which the state hadn't seen since it revolted against Mexico. Talk is cheap, but it can also be deadly. Witness the response of Art Harrison, who lived just outside of Slocum, who actually called people he knew in the nearby city of Elkhart and told them of the amassing of black armed residents in Anderson County. He urged a white counterattack at sunrise. Within the span of a few hours, outraged white Texans rounded up their arms and their neighbors, stashed their families in churches and schools, posted armed guards to protect them, and headed straight to Slocum, stopping only at gunsmiths and gun shops and bars for reinforcements. News was not just traveling fast now, it was flying. A district judge in the county got wind of what was coming his way and promptly issued a court order to close saloons, hardware stores, and arms dealers immediately. By the time the order began circulating, some of the gun sellers had already closed their doors because they had sold out. Almost everyone in the region was now on high alert. Everyone who was white, that is. The black community of Slocum had been left out of the preparations. Not much could have stopped what happened next. Texas Public Radio's David Martin Davies reporting in late 2015.
Soon there were more packs of armed men combing the area, shooting black people on sight, going from cabin to cabin, working their way through the woods, and continuing their methodical executions.
Tiny aside, the Washington Post would suggest the number of white Texans who found their way to Slocum was around 1,000. Lusk Holly had successfully fled, but circled back to warn his family and others. He joined up with them as they tried to make their way to safety in nearby Palestine. On the way, though, they were met by what he figured were 18 to 20 men. They were somewhere near Ione Creek, east of town. Lusk would later tell how it was quiet at first, but then he heard a whistle, an apparent signal to open fire. Lusk, who had escaped injury earlier on, was now shot in the lower left abdomen and arm. He saw that his older brother Alex had been shot dead. Lying still, Lusk pretended that he too was dead. Later, he would say that he recognized the voice of one of the men. The man, Jeff Wise, was someone Lusk knew. Lusk heard him remark that the Holly boys' deaths were a shame. Constance Holly Jawade is a Dallas area school administrator who spells her maiden name differently from the family that was gunned down or fled that day. The 1910 spelling was H-O-L-L-E-Y, but the survivors, when they moved away from Slocum, changed that spelling to H-O-L-L-I-E. She said they're proud Texans, proud Americans. Her father served this country in Vietnam. Her great-great-grandfather was Jack Holly's son and Lusk's older brother, Alex Holly, who was murdered that day.
I think it was probably the scariest day of my great-great-grandfather's life. You're trying to protect your sons, yourself, your wife, your children. I think it was terrifying.
Lee Craven, another descendant of a family attack that night, retells the story that has been passed down through generations of her family.
One of my relatives was in fact pursued inside his home and shot point blank range with a rifle while he sought refuge under a bed.
Writing in the Texas Observer in 2019, reporter Michael Barajas quoted Audrey Wilson, another descendant, who said his father, who was eight at the time, had been sitting on his father's lap. Crying, Audrey's mother begged the armed intruders to spare the little boy. Someone must have given her some kind of assent. She took her son from his father's lap, and then they shot the father dead in his own rocking chair in his own home. Then they left to kill other fathers and sons for the crime of being black. The black population of Slocum was situated along Sadler and Ione Creeks. After the Civil War, this land had been considered useless by the white farmers in the area as it was prone to flooding. Freed black farmers settled there, finding the bottom land exceptionally fertile, and they prospered. Some, like Jack Holly, were literate and business-minded. Holly had established a bank with all black partners. These men were helping their own insular community based in this small southeastern Anderson County burg to flourish. That success was now being obliterated. How long the actual slaughter lasted is disputed. Some accounts put the killing at 24 hours, other at a full 48 hours, suggesting the killings moved into other nearby counties on the following day. But the mob moved like Sherman through Atlanta, killing unarmed men, whether they were running from them or trying to shield their families from the bullets. On July 30th, Anderson County Sheriff William Black, a white man, arrived in Slocum, as did a bevy of Texas Rangers and state militia, to restore order. This is author E.R. Bills speaking to Texas Public Radio in 2015.
There is no official number. The newspaper reports originally suggested two dozen. Eventually, when there were indictments handed down, they were for seven casualties. But the sheriff of the day, or of the time, said that most of the bodies would be found by the buzzards. There were too many. They were everywhere. And strangely enough, no more were found after he said that. It appears that some of the perpetrators of the massacre went around covering the evidence. And in fact, some of the black families were retrieving their deceased loved ones to bury them and prevent further abuse. So it's not clear, but oral tradition suggests there were at least 200 killed.
Some say that number is either overstated or simply unverifiable. Sheriff Black wrote a report later that would damn the naysayers, saying that many dead still lay where they had been shot, in the deep woods among the brambles. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Ollie. Mealtime at our house used to be a mess. Alice eats slowly, Ripley tries to steal, and we had to separate them just to keep the peace.
But since we switched to Ollie, they both love it so much they finish fast, and we don't have to play referee anymore.
That's because Ollie is fresh, human-grade food made with real ingredients. No mystery meats, no artificial junk, just minimally processed meats from U.S. kitchens.
And with recipes like beef with sweet potatoes and turkey with blueberries, they actually get excited for mealtime.
Ollie even customizes the plan for your dog's needs, and the welcome kit comes with 2 weeks of meals, a free storage container, and a guide to transition them over.
Plus, you get free routine health screenings through their app, which helps keep tabs on your pup's well-being.
Dogs deserve the best, and that means fresh, healthy food. Head to Ollie.com/COTC, tell them about your dog, and use code COTC to get 60% off your welcome kit when you subscribe today.
Plus, they offer a happiness guarantee on your first box, so if you're not completely satisfied, you'll get your money back. That's OLLIE.com/COTC and enter code COTC to get 60% off your first box.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
The writing and rewriting of Slocum's Darkest Day began immediately. A few local papers tried to recast the slaughter. And the Palestine Daily Herald, the July 30th edition, reported that, quote, a race war was on, end quote. It said some 200 black people had armed themselves and were ready for trouble. The El Paso Herald followed with a headline that read something similar. Forgive the offensive language of the era. It read, quote, 10 Negroes are killed in Texas race riots, end quote. The Dallas Morning News originally reported that the race riot was responsible for 18 dead. One or two more headlines were even more overtly racist, using derogatory terms for the victims of the pogrom. Not all newspapers took the bait. The Houston Chronicle and Fort Worth Register quickly reported that white mobs had killed as many as 50 black residents in Slocum, noting that many bodies had been dumped into mass graves. The Chronicle even opined that perhaps the white population of East Texas was attempting to, quote-unquote, exterminate the black population there. The Fort Worth paper hedged a bit, writing that the violence was, quote, a culmination of smoldering hate between races in a community thickly populated, end quote, by people of color. A week later, the Chicago Defender, a black-owned newspaper of renown, mistakenly reported that the black farmers had staged their own Alamo-like stand and killed 200 white attackers in what they termed, quote, a pitched battle, 300 Negroes against 1,500 whites, end quote. That wasn't true. The New York Times and Washington Post, though, wasted no time in trying to ferret out what actually happened. They found themselves an unimpeachable source in Sheriff William Black. In the Times, on August 1, 1910, the Anderson County Sheriff was quoted as saying, and again, forgive the use of the era's offensive language here, quote, men were going about killing Negroes as fast as they could find them and, so far as I was able to ascertain, without any real cause. I don't know how many there were in the mob, but there may have been 200 or 300. They were just hunting the Negroes down like sheep, end quote. Such reportage brought outrage. None was more forceful than this from the Baptist Ministers Union, which sent a telegraph to Texas Governor Thomas Campbell on the night of August 1st. Quote, the 100 colored Baptist ministers of Washington, D.C. stand aghast at the wholesale murder of innocent and unarmed men which have disgraced Texas and exposed her to the contempt of the civilized world and is sure to bring upon her the condemnation of a just God. We have faith in your sense of justice and loyalty to duty and believe you will do everything in your power to have the murderers of those innocent men apprehended and punished, end quote. Governor Campbell, who had grown up near Slocum, did not really have to be nudged to action. He had already expressed his own horror about what had happened there and had immediately dispatched the state militia to quell the attacks. And the ministers' union was not wrong. The whole affair did not paint Texas in the kind of light that the burgeoning metropolises of Houston and Dallas had in mind. Oil and cotton futures looked too good to be spoiled by such ugliness. But it wasn't like Texas had a sparkling clean slate up to this point. According to the Texas State Historical Association, 1910 Texas was no refuge for Black Americans. Between 1885 and 1942, there were 465 lynchings recorded in the state. Of those, 339 were of Black people, the vast majority men, though Black women were also lynched. That total ranked among the highest in the nation, behind only Mississippi, Georgia, and Louisiana. Some of that nearly 60-year count was the result of so-called vigilante justice. And while some of that in Texas had been attributed to Wild West frontier justice, meted out by what was then considered legitimate courts, most involved prisoners being taken from supposedly safe custody and handed over to murderous mobs. In Bills's book, he recounts how in 1909, women in the town of Tyler were sending, quote, flowers by the wagon load, end quote, to the men accused of lynching a Black man there. Still, in another grim statistic, because I feel like I'm on a roll here, between 1891 and 1922, 31 Black people in Texas were also burned at the stake. That's something like one a year. According to the Zinn Education Project, leading up to the Slocum Massacre, Black residents living in East Texas were, quote, executed by a white mob based on allegations alone. No trials, no juries, simply white verdicts, end quote. Now, barely 3 months before the Slocum Massacre, Alan Brooks, a Black man living in Dallas, had been accused of raping a young white girl, something that many local leaders at the time doubted. Here's Adriana De Alba of WFAA in Dallas speaking to Rick Halperin, director of the Southern Methodist University Human Rights Education Program, about how a mob overran the courtroom where Brooks was being tried.
Generations today have to know what happened when they walk around in downtown Dallas. They have to realize it's a place of death. Dragged, literally, to the old red courthouse in downtown Dallas and then thrown out of the second story of that building.
Still alive, the mob dragged Brooks to Main and Ackert and hanged him from what was then Elk's Arch in front of thousands.
The murder soon became national news when a photograph of 100 spectators was made into a postcard that was mailed to family and friends across the country. All that said, there were some good and lawful people living in Texas in 1910 who tried to do the right thing. The state judge who had ordered saloons and hardware stores to stop selling guns and ammunition to the mobs on their way into town wasted no time in convening a grand jury to find and punish those responsible. He opened his remarks to the grand jury with words that were frank and to the point. Quote, all of you are white men and all of you are Southern men, and it is your duty now to investigate the killing and murder of a large number of Negroes, say at least 8 or possibly 10 or 12 or more, who have been killed in the southeastern part of your county by men of your color, end quote. He told the grand jurors that even if they found that some Black person had made a threat of any kind against a white person, quote, it would not justify anybody to take the law into their own hands. The law furnishes ample remedy, and it would be no excuse for shooting down anybody, end quote. In sum, he said, the massacre was a travesty of justice that was also a disgrace to the county and the entire state. Judge B.H. Gardner then left no stone unturned. He made sure that almost every resident in Slocum was subpoenaed to testify about what they knew and what they'd seen. If anyone, no matter how prominent, refused to testify, Gardner had them arrested and brought to his courtroom. He was not messing around. Hundreds were cross-examined. Gardner must have thought progress was being made. He was wrong. Crimes of the Century is sponsored by Cornbread Hemp. Life's been a little crazy lately. Sickness swept through the house and completely wrecked everyone's natural rhythm.
Yeah, bedtime went right out the window.
That's when I leaned on Cornbread Hemp CBD gummies. They really helped me unwind and actually get some rest at night.
And you like the flavors, right?
I do, the peach and the watermelon especially. And they only use the best part of the hemp plant, the flower, for the purest and most potent CBD.
Plus, everything's USDA organic and third-party lab tested, so you know you're getting quality.
Right now, Crimes of the Century's listeners can save 30% on their first order. Just head to cornbreadhemp.com/COTC and use code COTC at checkout.
That's cornbreadhemp.com/COTC. Use code COTC.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Judge B.H. Gardner was doing everything in his power to hold someone, anyone, accountable for the massacre in Slocum. The killings had shocked the nation, and under his orders, the Texas Rangers were rounding up the most obvious offenders. On August 2, 1910, just 4 days after the slaughter, a few arrests were made. 2 days later, Gardner asked the governor to appoint a former state assistant attorney general to help the Anderson County prosecutor sift out the truth and mete out justice. Locally, Gardner was almost alone in his quest. A nearby justice of the peace went on record saying he knew where the blame should rest, and it wasn't on any white shoulders. Placing fault for their own deaths on the men who weren't yet even cold, the justice of the peace declared that the black male population had overstepped. Quote, "They'd become very insolent toward the white people and would ride by the houses where the white women were, with the hats cocked on the side of their head, whistling," end quote. Clutch my pearls. Now, I said Gardner was almost alone. Support did come from some unexpected places. John A. Sidon, the only postmaster ever employed in the tiny town of Volga, Texas, was clearly angered by the slaughter and its death toll. He wrote a letter to the Texas Republican State Executive Committee chairman. He asked for anonymity, as he feared being killed if people knew how he felt. He wrote, quote, "For humanity's sake, if you have any influence with the federal government, prevail on the proper authorities to investigate the conditions that prevail in this country as regards the Negro." Some 20 or 30 colored people were murdered at Slocum in Anderson County, Texas, for no other reason than the Lord had made them black, end quote. He wrote that he feared the trials would be farcical, that no one would be punished, that black people in the area were still treated as enslaved, regularly overcharged for common goods, flogged for small infractions, and kept in eternal debt. The letter was heartfelt. Sidon mentioned in closing that he was white and a Republican, though he admitted he voted in Democratic primaries. That letter was read by the party chair and sent directly to the United States Attorney General. There was even a follow-up note to make sure the Attorney General had received it. This was at the same time that the Colored Ministers Union had written to President William Howard Taft, pleading for help. The letter, sent on August 13th, explained, quote, "In the past, we put confidence in statecraft to save us from exploitation at the behest of the strong, but the best we have ever received from it is not enough to deliver us from the troubles of which we now complain. We sought strength through education, but the more we advance along this line, the greater the discrimination. We have bought land, built homes, and established churches, but those states, as desire to do so, go on disenfranchising us, lynching our men on frivolous charges and unproved allegations, and widening the chasm which race differentiation has made broad enough. There is no wrong that cannot be put away by good men determined to do it," end quote. 10 days later, the acting attorney general of this country responded to the minister's union in government speak and platitudes. Quote, "The protection of life and property is generally a duty devolving upon the state authorities. Your letter and petition deal with the subject of the treatment of colored persons generally, and therefore furnished no facts which would warrant this department in taking any steps to redress the wrongs complained of. Should there come to your attention any specific case in which a federal right is violated, and you will submit a detailed statement of the facts, the department will be glad to take such action as the ends of justice require," end quote. A week before the federal government brushed off calls for intervention, on August 17, 1910, survivors Luss Colley and Charlie Wilson were the last to testify in Judge Gardner's Palestine court. They told how their friend, Cleve Larkin, was the first to be gunned down. It had happened in the middle of a dirt road, not 500 yards from the house where they'd spent the night. They told how they had escaped, albeit wounded. They told how they were shot at again that same day and struck again. By then, 11 white men had been arrested, but only 7 were eventually indicted in 2 counties, Houston and Anderson, on charges of first-degree murder for the killings of 5 black men. As Bills wrote, the fact that white men were even charged with the murder of black men, quote, was a first for East Texas, if not the state of Texas, end quote. On November 14, 1910, the defendants were arraigned in Houston County. A month later, the same was done in Anderson County. That's when Gardner announced he wanted a change of venue. He did not trust any jury that would be seated in his own county. After some wrangling, all parties agreed for the case to be tried in Harris County, the county in which Houston, Texas, is located. And yes, Houston isn't in Houston County. Texans love naming things after Sam Houston so much, they doubled up. Anyway, shortly afterward, the Houston County indictments were also moved to Harris County for prosecution. It's hard to know what the black residents of Slocum thought about any of this. That's largely because there now were no black residents left in Slocum. The wholesale annihilation of so many was followed very quickly by the entire black population of the town leaving their well-tended farms, the title to their lands, their hard-earned banks, stores, and homes, and moving on. A few ended up less than 50 miles away, most simply disappeared into other communities. Constance Holly Jewett again.
We were prosperous until the white surrounding community became envious and put a halt to our upward economic trajectory.
The exodus left their stories fragmented and, in surely a few cases, wholly untold. That's because, after the cases were moved to Harris County and the accused made bail while they awaited what was going to happen next, nothing did. Much later, Judge Gardner would be at a loss for specifics about what exactly took place in the halls of justice in Harris County. He figured, though, that it came down to money. Quote, "In those days, the prosecuting attorney's principal pay came from fees for convictions, and the district or county attorney for Harris County felt that he could not put his time in on prosecuting white men for killing Negroes in another county," end quote. Life went on in Slocum. The land where black families had thrived was quickly claimed by white landowners, who treated it as abandoned. Judge Gardner ended up exchanging a few physical blows in later years with 2 of the men who had been charged in his court with instigating the 1910 killings. No one in the scuffles were seriously hurt. After that, Gardner is said to have gotten a permit to carry a gun for his own protection, but swore he had no idea how to use it. Much later, the son of a local minister who had heard of the supposed impending black uprising in Slocum told how his father had decided to ride with the mob that day because he feared for the safety of his family. He participated in the killings. But when he learned the truth, that the people slaughtered had been unarmed and that the uprising was nothing but a lie, he couldn't live with the guilt. He died by suicide. In a roundabout way, that made him the only white victim of the massacre.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
Two ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
Play Monopoly at McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playmcd.com for full details and amoe.playmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
The tragedy of the Slocum Massacre didn't end in July 1910. It compounded as the days, years, even decades wore on. The ongoing tragedy is that no one ever tallied the dead, much less named them. The 1910 indictments named just 8 victims of the wanton murders, even though Gardner knew that was a gross undercount. And families who fled that day would tell of many more, but no one came around to ask them. Shouldn't the local undertakers have known? Well, yes, but the problem wasn't bodies and burials, because, as I suggested earlier, there's little question that Black families gathered up their dead quickly before leaving. There's an equally strong feeling that white shooters, knowing that law enforcement was closing in, may have also done some gathering and dumping. That feeling was bolstered by eyewitness testimony at the time and oft-told family stories since, that the white mob had shoveled large numbers of the dead in hastily dug pits, ditches, and ravines, shallow and barely covered. J.W. Hayes, a doctor in the area at the time of the massacre, told his son, Granville, also a doctor, that he had been told by reliable white witnesses about bodies being quickly buried near the Silver Creek School, just southeast of Slocum, just about where the playground would have been. Granville Hayes had lobbied local authorities to investigate the massacre, something they, in writing, said they were doing. He even offered his family's land for the placement of a historic marker. With little movement on that front for a few years, Hayes continued to ask about the investigation, only to find there had been none. More than 10 years ago, Holly Juwaid was one of those survivors who thought it was time someone went looking for the bodies.
There are hundreds of people who are buried in mass graves in Slocum, not just our family members, but there were many other families that were killed during the massacre.
The bodies could, in fact, be anywhere in what is still very rural and very overgrown piney woods. The amount of equipment required to even begin a geophysical search has proved restrictive. So, too, the very ground, its location and chemical makeup, in which the bodies may have been thrown. Animals, wind, or water could have easily disturbed the skeletal remains and scattered them. Roots could have grown over and through them. They could have been weathered, damaged, and altered. But Slocum is still a small town. The 2020 census recorded a population of just 549. Holly Juwaid's efforts to unearth the truth have met considerable resistance. Authorities drag their feet, landowners have refused access. One landowner told her she could pay her respects from the other side of the fence, but was so enraged by her entreaties to gain access that he had the county send her a note of forbidden entry. So she changed tactics. After a 2011 Fort Worth Star-Telegram story by Tim Madigan about the 100th anniversary of the massacre, a whole new generation of Texans wanted to help. Holly Juwaid led the charge, figuring the next logical step was to get a historical marker about the massacre placed in Slocum. It was the least the county could do, and might open some doors for further historical efforts. Holly Juwaid explaining,
"We were a proud people who owned businesses, a granary, a general store, a dairy, acres and acres of land. We were prosperous until the white surrounding community became envious and put a halt to our upward economic trajectory. So I want them to know that our history is more than slavery in this country, that we come from great people, hardworking men and women, and it's not slavery. Slavery was an interruption of our success. It is not who we are.
But the county was not receptive to the application. Jimmy Ray Odom, longtime chair of the Anderson County Historical Commission, while explaining that he wasn't a racist, made it clear he was not going to erect a marker to an event that he wasn't sure happened. He blocked any recognition of what happened in Slocum.
The Slocum massacre, the newspaper accounts, when you put them all together and read every one of them, they differ on everything that happened.
Also against the commemoration was County Commissioner Greg Chapin, who represented District 1 in Anderson County. He told Texas Public Radio that
it's just lack of evidence. I mean, it just doesn't have a, it's all hearsay, no factual. You know, everything that the commission works off of is all, you know, basically evidence that have been proven, you know, as far as documented by some of our peers, as far as judged, you know what I mean, as far as not just hearsay.
He went on to say that the county had looked at all the information and found that it contradicted itself about how many were, and he added, weren't, killed. A reminder, there were no white people killed that day. Court records of all those several hundred who spoke to the grand jury might have offered some assistance here. Well, they might have. But 3 years after the mass executions, on January 6, 1913, an angry defendant in a separate case rigged a couple of incendiaries, and the Anderson County Courthouse burned to the ground. Tiny aside, per the Portal to Texas History, an archive established by the University of North Texas, the records the arsonist wanted to destroy were stored in fireproof rooms and survived. The Slocum case files, well, they did not. But newspaper archives kept the story alive. When Anderson County refused to mark the massacre, Holly Jewade went over their heads to the Texas State Historical Commission. Odom, when asked why he wasn't signing off on the marker, told the state commission that the massacre was, quote-unquote, dramatically overstated. He said it would be a shame to mark the area as a racist one from now until the end of time. The state ignored him and unanimously approved the marker, though the wording was sanitized. Installed January 18, 2016, the marker described the massacre as a deadly eruption of racial violence that left several dead. Here's some inside journalism baseball. When we don't know real numbers, but we know it's more than three, we use vague words like several. David Davies, again from Texas Public Radio.
Due to the limits of documentation, the marker is only able to list eight of the murder victims. And in their memory, on Saturday at the marker's unveiling, a bell was rung eight times.
Davies was on hand that day. He added that across the street from the Slocum Public School, where the dedication events took place, a new Confederate flag hung from a porch. Kalisha Holly Williams talked to reporters.
We're not trying to stir the pot, per se, but all we're trying to do is bring awareness to what happened and justice.
Slocum's reputation for an overarching hospitality to all has not recovered. Granted, it was never all that hospitable to the Black families who had built homes, churches, banks, and stores there. They had lived alongside those who did not like them, but they had liked it enough to put down roots. The hesitancy to return has not abated. This is Garrison Hayes, host of Town of Fire, in an episode that highlighted what happened in Slocum.
Needless to say, this once thriving community was never the same. For decades, this story went unacknowledged in Texas education, though the impacts are still felt today. More than 110 years later, demographic data paints a startling picture of the lasting legacy of this massacre. While nearby towns boast Black populations of more than 20%, the Black population of Slocum sits just below 7%. a chilling reminder that some wounds take longer than others to heal.
That's an odd statistic, given how locals claim the murders were forgotten so quickly. Of course, Texas forgot. Texas history textbooks never thought to include it. In 2015, rocks that had been stacked to designate where family elder Jack Holly had been buried were moved aside. In the Oakwood Cemetery, 30 miles from Slocum, his descendants finally gave him a proper headstone. On the line under his name, the simple epitaph, "Our Patriarch and Pioneer." The next line, the simple wish, "Remember Slocum." To research this case and write this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read E.R. Bill's The 1910 Slocum Massacre, an Act of Genocide in East Texas. She read as many archival stories as she could find in a wide variety of publications. She also read the Fort Worth Star-Telegram's most recent reporting on the efforts to educate and remind the state of the slaughter. Texas Public Radio's ongoing coverage and reporting from the Texas Observer also proved essential, as did background material from the Texas State Historical Commission and other state archives. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Join us at patreon.com/grabbagcollab to hear not just exclusive content related to this show, but to also get access to several other shows on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this show was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Amanda Rossman and Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and occasionally by my son, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Soundstripe and Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, help us out by rating and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case, now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.